You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. I'm Graham Wilgos. The countdown to the Tour de France continues here with me again this week, taking you all the way to the Tour's Grand Départ in Florence on the 29th of June. In just 18 days' time, the Cycling Podcast's Tour A-Team. Richard Faceman Abraham, how are we doing, Rich?
Hi, Graham. Is this the A-Team reference? Because that's way over. That's far too early for me.
We'll come back to that. And Mitch, Mitch B.A. Baracus Docker, how are we doing, Mitch?
Yeah, I'm good. Is it 18
it's
days?
Nuts, isn't it?
It's counting down.
It's going to be here quicker than you know. So we should set the scene this week and say that we're all recording remotely. So I'm sure Richard's very happy to say that we're not sharing headphones this week, me and him. And Mitch, you're back home in Melbourne.
I'm back home, yeah. I live just outside of Melbourne, up in Land Vegas. Lancefield is known to some other people. But, yeah, back home today. Just got back from Lancefield Run Club, so feeling fresh, ready to rock and roll.
Pleased to hear it. Rich, Oxfordshire for you?
Oxfordshire, yeah. Although I've been preparing for our expedition you listened to a Giro episode when Daniel mentioned a Norwegian explorer called Thor Heyerdahl who passed away on the Italian Riviera. It reminded me I had this old copy of the Kon-Tiki expedition, so I've been extracting myself from what feels like quite wintry conditions at the moment and imagining that I'm on a raft in the South Pacific and kind of thinking that this is quite good preparation for about to embark on a 3.5 week odyssey with you guys.
Is it not warm in the UK yet?
Nah. Do you see the women's tour? It's been horrible.
I know,
it's been worse than usual, Mitch.
I left the flat yesterday in the same jacket that I was wearing in December to go. To go and do what I can.
So bring on the summer heat wave in France. I can't wait. It's going to be a shock when we land in Nice. So
I was going
to get over to Florence.
I was going to ask you, chaps, actually, just as a beginner, what are you looking forward to? So I the obvious one for me and Richard is probably the sun, but what are you most looking forward to about getting out to Italy and then France? Mitch, to start with you.
Yeah, well, I think like probably the weather for me, because look, I'm coming out of winter. And look, it's always nice to get back to Europe. You know, I spent so many of my years over there. Even though I say it, I don't miss living there. Every time you go back, you're like, you romanticize about the good bits. And just as it's getting annoying, you're like, cool, I'm out of here. See you, boys. Back to Aussie, back to the pub, get myself a cold beer.
And how many tours will this be for you?
I don't know how you guys do it, but look, I've been on three, but I only did a week the first year and then 2 weeks the last 2 years. So I never rode one, but I've been a journo for the last three.
And Richard, how about you?
I think 7 or 8. Not whole tours, but yeah, getting up there. It's just that first night when we land, you know, I'm kind of picturing Florence in that sort of soupy, dusky summer evening, you know? Three of us finally there. That sense of anticipation you get before the tour kicks off. There, you know, you see people. Well, we'll be in a big city, Florence. Loads of tourists. You know, a busy place anyway. But you know, you'll see like a press officer over there. You'll see another journalist over there in that bar. You know, be walking around and that sense of like feeling that you're joining this convoy and this sort of enterprise, this whole thing that's about to get rolling. And it's quite a special feeling when you kind of become part of that and like jump on that bus and ready to go.
It's that buzz at the start.
Yeah, not a literal bus, unless Graham, you've been looking into rental options.
No, it's more of a buzz than a bus, but
yeah, good.
this will be my third tour in various guises. I commentated from a booth in the middle of London for TalkSport in 2022, and followed it the year before with Brad with Wigo for the Eurosport Bradley Wiggins Show podcast. So it'll be a voyage of discovery that I'm looking forward to going on together when we finally get there. But it's but not long now. Rich, should we crack on with the news?
Let's. Yeah. Lots to talk about this week. Of course, well, we're getting ready for the tour, but so are a lot of the main contenders at the Critérium du Dauphiné, the big race this week. 8 seconds, probably the most famous time gap in cycling history, from Greg LeMond and Laurent Fignon in the tour, was the gap between Primoz Roglic and Matteo Jorgensen at the Critérium du Dauphiné. Quite an exciting race in the end, actually. Well, a very exciting race. And a surprise podium for Derek G, 36 seconds down. I was hoping to speak to Derek, actually, but it sounds like Israel Premier Tech had a bit of a nightmare return with cancelled flights and whatnot. So we'll let Derek get his rest, well-deserved rest, and we'll hope to speak to him before the tour. But very impressive ride from Derek, and I think a lot of people will be looking out for him in the tour. We'll do the proper Dauphiné analysis in the episode, so we'll just wrap it up. Mitch, unfortunately, Jack Haig did not get fifth. He was 16th.
I 12 know. Minutes down. I saw.
Big prediction.
I was hoping, because I had him on the pod as well during the week on my own podcast, Life in the Peloton. Go across and have a listen. But yes, and we talk about that fifth, and I thought, oh, how cool would it be if he got another fifth? And I know he was probably going for it, but unfortunately, I had a look, you know, like having a look at De Plus, who got fifth, and understanding what it takes to be fifth in such a race, you're like, hang on, three times fifth in the Dauphiné is something to actually hang your hat on, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. De Plus, well, we'll get on to this. De Plus, an impressive domestique for Carlos Rodriguez on Ineos. We'll run through the stage winners in order. Mads Pedersen and Magnus Cort Nielsen last week, before we were recording, took the first two stages. There were stage wins for Derek G, Remco Evenepoel, nobody at all on stage five following a crash, which was one of the big talking points of the race. And then in those final three mountain stages, two wins for Primoz Roglic and a final stage win for Carlos Rodriguez. We'll leave the GC and the rest of that for the moment. The Tour de Suisse is underway at the moment. It got underway at the weekend in Liechtenstein. Swiss and Liechtenstein nationality rider. Anyone know who that is? Joint citizenship?
Ooh.
Well, the clock's ticking. It's Stefan Kung, eighth in the opening prologue. That was really, I mean, if it's ever going to be a race for you, a home race, that's it. Swiss Liechtenstein. But Yves Lampaert won that opening TT. Stage two won by Brian Coquard, which is only his second World Tour win. A big one for him, a big one for his Cofidis team as well. Looking ahead to this week, well, the sixth stage was going to be the Queen stage. That's been shortened because of the snowpack on the Furka and the Nufinen passes. So that's now gone down to just over 40k. High point of the race is going to be on stage four. That's tomorrow as we record it, I believe. So what will that be? Wednesday. The high point of the race is the Gotthard Pass, and the race organisers are awarding a Gino Maeder Prize, which I think I mentioned last week, the hashtag Ride for Gino Mountain Prize. It works a bit like the Cima Coppi in the Giro for the first rider over the high point of the race. It's really going to boil down to the last two stages, kind of based near Aigle, the headquarters of the UCI. There's a big mountain sort of circuit race almost of just under 120k. And then the final stage is a 16k TT with nearly 900 meters of vertical ascent. So it's a big climbers race. Lots of names to look out for. It's basically the Tour de France long list, a bit like at the Dauphiné. A few Giro returnees. Not an exhaustive list, but look out for Egan Bernal, Tom Pidcock, Sergio Higuita, Felix Gau, Richard Carapaz, our own Larry Warbass. Probably check in with Larry for next week, perhaps. Lenny Martinez, Enric Mas, Kian Oitcherbrooks, who quit the Giro, Ben Tulett and Wilco Kelderman, Adam Yates, Mark Hirschi, and, well, no true sprint stages, but a great sprint lineup. Basically some mountain training going on there for some of those riders. Mark Cavendish, Arnaud Démare, Dan McClay, Jordi Meus, Arnaud Delis, Pascal Ackermann. So a lot of big names to look out for there with an eye on the tour. Moving on to a little news story about Visma Lisabike. They've confirmed the person or the people who are going to replace the outgoing team manager, Marijn Zeeman. Zeeman, pretty instrumental in the sort of evolution of that team, really, to the Grand Tour powerhouse that they are now. He's moving to soccer, to football, and he's being replaced by a team of five. Most interestingly, an appointment from outside cycling, a chap called Jaakko Vaharen, who is currently the director of the French swimming team. So,
he used to be head coach of the Australian swimming team, Mitch. I don't know if his name has reached cycling circles down under.
No, well, I don't even really know his name. I'm not really as much into my swimming as everyone else in the whole of Australia is. They love their swimming here. It just bores me a bit, the old swimming. It's just a bit repetitive, isn't it? But they froth on it out here, and we get to see every state champion, and it gets primetime TV and even the club champs. And yeah, we've got a good record, so he's going to, whatever he's doing, works.
I'm trying to think of a segue for this story, but I can't really force it. But let's go over to Kansas and a story which I spotted, which kind of talking of swimming or showering. Anyway, Lawrence Ten Dam and Thomas Dekker, it seems like they spent 10 hours in a prison cell in Kansas. The story goes that they were having a makeshift shower in a car park before going out for food. The police got called when a local onlooker took issue. And it seems like they fell foul of the state's laws on public decency. So an interesting little story. They both got out in time to race Unbound. It made me think that we probably need to brush up on French laws on public indecency before we pour bottles of Vittel over ourselves at the Tour de France. France has experienced a heat wave this spring already. Météo France says there's going to be hotter than average conditions this summer. We don't go much further north than Troyes, which is south of Paris already. So, things will be hotting up in a different sense in France. Are we going to have Mitch's story about?
I think we should. Before we do, we should just double click on the. So I think the charge was outraging public decency for Lawrence Ten Dam and Dekker. But they had a 3-hour training ride, and they attempted to clean off in the car park so they could go for a Mexican lunch. And the next thing they knew, says Thomas Dekker, they were surrounded by police. But the quote that really stood out for me was, he said, "I didn't dare do anything. I had five guns pointing at me," which it's to go from having a quiet shower and trying to clean up for lunch to five guns and surrounded by police. It's it's quite the turnaround. But Mitch, that's now that we've given you that segue. Anything as outrageous ever happened to you?
Are you going to hit that one out of the park, Mitch, or leave that one through to the slips?
I need to know a bit more about the details of the story because back when I was riding Tour Down Under, we had the ice bars set up. And if anyone's ever been to the Tour Down Under, there's the village set up in the middle of Adelaide in Victoria Square, which is just a normal square in the middle of the city, but they fence it off with all, big fencing, and you've got the tour village there and stuff like that. So as riders, once you go in there, it's all fenced off. But they had ice bars set up, and everyone was jumping in the ice bars and their sweaty old nicks and this sort of thing. And I just thought, you know what? We're in this closed off area. I'm just going to whip my nicks off and just jump in the ice bath starkers, have a quick ice bath. My towel's right next to me, and jump out of the ice bath, wrap my towel around me. And that was it. I didn't think anything of it. And later on that night, race director Mike Turter, he came storming into the dining room straight up to my table. He's like, "Were you down there exposing yourself to the whole of Adelaide in the middle of in the middle of Victoria Square there at the ice bath?" I was like, "Oh, no." Because I didn't realise that from the Hilton, obviously, you could look down into where we are. So even though no one could see me outside of that little village, once you got up about, two stories, you could see straight into the village, and you would have just seen little Mitch sort of swimming around, I guess.
Fortunately, this is possibly at a time where phone cameras weren't quite so prevalent. So it sounds like you got away with it. No police were called.
Well, it wasn't that long ago. It was only a couple of years, 5 years ago.
Okay, well, I take that back.
And this is of the kind of things that team buses have removed from the experience of following professional cycling is a sort of exposure to public nudity. But certainly like smaller races where people are getting ready in a camper van or, out the boot of a car, or you're wandering down a hotel corridor and people are going in and out of the soigneur's room for their massage and stuff, you'd be surprised
Well, that's the thing. Like, if you've raced anywhere in Belgium or, you know, Holland or whatever it is, it's just there's no, you're not exposing yourself to anyone. You're just literally getting changed, you know, and you're just going about your business. So, look, I've got no idea what happened with those guys, but I can imagine it's just the simple, you know, at the end of a Kermesse, just quickly get changed, shower off, get clean.
It's a culture clash. It's like you say.
Yeah. It's a total culture clash, yeah. But like, once again, I don't know the details of the story, but it sounds like they got, yeah, not the quite the preparation they wanted for a 320k race
for Unbound. Yeah,
let's move on, shall we?
Move us on, for goodness sake.
Move us on
from one shock to another, possibly.
Something which has been happening in the real world, I suppose, so to speak, is President Macron in France has just called some snap elections, which are going to take place on June the 30th and July the 7th. So assembly or parliamentary elections, smack bang in the middle of the tour. The first round of voting, we're going to be in Italy, but the second round will be on the same day as the Troyes gravel stage. We'll keep an eye on this. I mean, it's obviously probably not what the Tour would have wanted. The mayor of Paris has come out already and said that the snap election is deeply troubling. I mean, I suppose the proximity to the Olympics, obviously on her mind, and I suspect the Tour organisers would agree as well, both from a sort of security perspective, but also from the perspective of... people are going to be out voting, not sitting at home watching the Tour de France. So, Paris-Roubaix has been moved in the past to make way and to accommodate the presidential elections in 2022. It swapped dates with Amstel Gold Race. So, you know, it's not ideal to have the Tour going on at the same time as these big elections. So it'd be a bit of a headache, I think. We'll keep an eye on that and wait and see.
It'll be interesting to see the mood while we're out there and see, because things tend to mesh more and more. So it'll be interesting to see how that sort of appears.
Suffice to say, the Tour is not apolitical. Sport, you know, and politics are closely intertwined. So, yeah, I suspect we won't be... that will be definitely in the background of the Tour when we make it there. Let's finish off with the Women's Tour of Britain. Almost a clean sweep for SD Works. The relaunch Tour of Britain Women up in the northwest of England, where it looked typically northwest England-y in June, unfortunately. two stages to Lotta Kopecky. The third stage went to her teammate Lorena Wiebers. And then, well, it looked like Kopecky was trying to set up Christine Majerus, her teammate, for the fourth and final stage, but she was pipped by Ruby Roseman Gannon from Liv Alula Jayco. Kopecky got the GC from Anna Henderson riding for GB, and Majerus, who was third. Of course, one of the big stories that came out of that race was the theft of the team bikes belonging to Life Plus Wahoo, a team who, like us, are clothed by our clothing partners MAP. They got cleaned out in a hotel car park before stage two. So what happened was all the rival teams chipped in with the spare bikes in order to keep Life Plus Wahoo on the road, which was a great story. And I mean, they got used, didn't they, straight away? Spare bikes, riders were hopping on Specialized for the first times, and yeah, it was quite a nice story in the end, I guess, how the teams and the mechanics donating their time to build those bikes up and so on. So a nice story that came out of adversity there.
And we should also mention, just because they are our official partners, but the MAP, let's give them a little shout out as well, who sponsor Life Plus Oahu. And it was good to see, appropriately in the end, Maddie Leach and Heidi Franz on the podium to collect the overall combativity award after the final stage of the Tour of Britain. There's a lot of official involvement, a lot of police involvement in the news this week. Investigating the theft of bikes, investigating indecent exposure in car parks.
Yeah. whether Rose and Denny are going to go into that much detail in the Cycling Podcast Feminan next week, but they will be back. So look out for that in your podcast feed. Worth mentioning as well, I'm sure it's a story they'll cover, is that the Tour de France Femme for 2025... the Grand Départ has been announced as taking place in Brittany, and the race has been up to 9 days as well, which is, I think, a step in the right direction and quite interesting, making that a pretty substantial race now. So that, gents, concludes the news roundup.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour,
and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, a VPN is a virtual private network to keep your data safe and secure wherever and whenever you are online. And with the Tour de France coming up, I hope all the guys have got their NordVPN subscriptions all set so that when they're online on their phones or laptops, they know that they are browsing the internet safely and securely. Because when you're at the Tour de France, sometimes you're picking up all sorts of hotspots and you don't want to have your data compromised in any way. I remember once on the tour, I was on the Col d'Izoard trying to send some copy to a newspaper that I was working for at the time. I was actually sitting on the car roof trying to get as high as possible and holding up my mobile phone to get a signal, sending off my copy to the newspaper. And, well, I didn't back then think for a second about my online security. I think we're all a little bit more savvy these days, and when you click to connect to the internet, you want to make sure that your information is completely safe and secure, especially because we take our phones for granted now, don't we? And we can do pretty much everything on them. Access your bank account on the phone app, and you want to make sure that your connection is as safe as it can possibly be. And NordVPN can give you that security. And of course, there are other benefits too, such as when you're going away, perhaps on a work trip or on holiday, and you want to watch your favorite box set, or maybe Unchained on Netflix uninterrupted, although I think Unchained is going to be available in all territories, isn't it? But you can use your NordVPN to log on as if you were at home. So give NordVPN a try. You can go to nordvpn.com/TCP. That's for the Cycling Podcast. It's nordvpn.com/TCP. And it's risk-free too, because Nord offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if it's not for you, unlikely I know, you can get your money back. Now, before I hand back to our Tour de France team of Graham, Richard and Mitch, just a reminder, in case you missed it last week, that there is going to be a plaque unveiling to remember our great friend Richard Moore, who passed away in 2022 at the West Lothian Cycle Circuit in Linlithgow, Scotland, on Saturday, July the 20th, between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. All Cycling Podcast listeners, and especially friends of the podcast, very, very welcome to come Saturday, July the 20th, up in Linlithgow. And if you've got a Cycling Podcast jersey or casquette of any vintage, do please wear it. Bring your bike, do a few laps of the circuit. If you can't bring your bike, just come along for a cup of tea. We'd be delighted to see you. So that's July the 20th, Saturday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the West Lothian Cycle Circuit in Linlithgow.
So, gents, I want to dive straight back into the Dauphiné. Plenty to talk about with a Roglification, to take Daniel Freeb's turn of phrase or trademark, that very nearly unraveled with what was a thrilling final or the thrilling finale for the GC picture. Let's open up with what that might tell us about the Tour de France as well. So I think the headline takeaway in terms of the GC men is that we've got an absolutely amazing prospect for 3 weeks in July, just on the strength of those last 8 kilometres alone on that Category 1 finish. It looked like, Mitch, Matteo Jorgensen might just nick it at the death, because Roglic, having taken 2 stages and looking absolutely imperious, all of a sudden found himself in a bit of trouble.
That's the thing. It looked like, okay, we've got a real contender here, you know, for, you know, Pogacar. If we see the same Pogacar that we saw at the Giro, and we're like, oh, okay, here we go. This is a sort of bulletproof Roglic. He's come in with his team. Vlasov looking, you know, for me, Vlasov was a real standout, maybe the second best rider in the race, I think.
Man of the match.
So I'm thinking, okay, with a guy like Primoz coming off his wheel, then all of a sudden, because we only got the coverage out here sort of midway through that last stage, and Ineos were already on the front foot. So I think they saw a kink in the armor in that last stage of Roglic, because they went on the front foot and they were like putting it down. They hit the, and also Trek as well. Trek came into that last climb as well, and it was like, okay, what's going on here? I was trying to work it out. Why are these guys just launching? Ciccone launches off straight away. And then clearly they knew what was going on because he wasn't on. And to see Jorgensen going away, like, it just, again, surprised me after my comments last week. You know, Dauphiné and Paris-Nice, they're very different races. Maybe it's going to be a bit too mountainous. You know, maybe it's completely unraveled what I said and showed superior level. Look, going into the Tour, he's really shown this amazing form. He just keeps getting better and better. The thing I liked about the end was, and I don't know whether this is true, there was almost an unspoken word between Jorgensen and Rodriguez. I don't know if you guys noticed this. As they came up the last K, it was like the cameras went away, so we didn't get to see if they looked across at each other and said something. But it was like he'd gone, you ride, I'll give you the stage, but we're riding for time, because he didn't even try and come around him, even if he couldn't or whatever. He's just like, you've got the stage, I just need time. And they just rode hard to the line, which is quite cool to see, actually. You don't see that anymore. Remind me a bit of the old school, you know, like, hey, you get the stage, I ride for time. And he went for it. And, you know, 8 seconds in the end, that stage victory would have brought it right down. It would have been right on the line. I think it would have been 4 seconds in the end if he'd won the stage. But
if he'd have got the 10 bonus seconds on the line,
exactly.
Yeah.
So I 100% agree with you that the Dauphiné, for me, it just kept lifting up. Was really cool, really exciting race. The crack of Roglic now, seeing also Remco as well, like seeing him ride through it and potentially building for like what's going to be at the Tour. There's lots of stuff coming out of this. It's going to be interesting, as you, Richard, spoke about before. We've got a whole other crew at Swiss now, and now we're going to come out of that with a whole lot of questions as well.
I think,
Rich,
let's
just touch on...
Well, something I picked up when Roglic had saved the race and he was doing his warm down and, you know, he had a microphone shoved in his face.
It's the worst interview I'd ever seen.
But something he said, which really kind of resonated with me, was like, you know, the one of the first questions was like, well, what about the Tour then? And Roglic's answer was, well, let's just enjoy the moment. And that's kind of the curse of the Dauphiné, isn't it? Is that everything that happens in the Dauphiné is consumed or understood in the context of, well, what's coming in however many days it was, 18 days, 3 weeks, whatever. You know, what does all this mean for the Tour? But actually, if you take the Dauphiné as a standalone race, it was superb, wasn't it? The fact that it came down to the wire like that, and to have those two riders separated by that time on the road, both going flat out to the line, and you didn't know who was going to win it until Roglic crossed the line. There was the intrigue about, you know, obviously Roglic was chasing down a rider from his old team, although Jorgensen wasn't there when he was riding for them, but, you know, he's riding for Bora, who are kind of trying to prove themselves as a real Grand Tour outfit that can support a leader like Roglic. And so, you know, Jai Hindley as well, playing a pretty key role, although I think you're right, Vlasov was definitely like the kind of most valuable player for them. So much to digest, but also just like, I don't know, kind of quite nice to look at it as a thing in itself rather than necessarily what it means for the Tour.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think Roglic is totally thinking about the Tour, and he was using that as a decoy. Even though that's true what you say, he was not going to the Dauphiné and just going, holy hell, I just won the Dauphiné. I am like ecstatic, you know, the Dauphiné is so big. He was using it as a decoy to just get off the topic of what actually happened today, dude. Are you like somewhat nervous? Because he just kept referring back to it. Oh, no, let's just enjoy this moment. Let's just enjoy this moment. I'm like, I understand what you're saying, but like Jorgensen, in another way, if he had said that, you'd be like, yeah, totally, dude. Let's just actually enjoy this. This is the first time you won the Dauphiné. But I feel like Roglic was trying to use it, even though justifiable, what you said. Yes, we need to actually understand you just won the Dauphiné for the second time. But he was using it as a bit of a decoy because I think, you know, he was just sort of freaking out, like, what the hell happened today?
Do you reckon, though, that he'll actually, the way that race panned out on that final climb up to Plateau de Glière, like they stopped short of the gravel bit, didn't they? So they kind of went up the other side of the Glière, which we've known from the Tour in past years with that gravel section. But in a way, is it better preparation for the Tour for Roglic have had to come through that test that adversity rather than having, you know, a cakewalk where it's all been plain sailing and he's been dominant. You know, to actually have kind of be pushed up against the wall and have to dig it out like that, burn through your teammates, have it in the balance. You know, there's a lot. I suppose you can look at that in both ways.
Yeah, totally. That's what I was about to say, and just sit on the fence. You probably don't want to hear that. But yeah, look, coming out of that, winning it successfully, having a team nailed, you come out of it with confidence. Hey, we've got this. We're ready to take on the best. You know, we're ready to take on Pogacar and UAE and whoever else has dealt to us. We've got this. We got through it. It was hard, but we controlled the situation. Everyone threw what they had at us, and we were invincible, you know. Look at Jumbo, or Visma Lisa bike the years before, you know, that's the mentality they had. Now there's a question of doubt there. Yes, that makes you go away and not sort of take anything for granted, but I don't think they ever are doing that. I don't think they're ever finishing the Dauphiné and going, we've got this. We just won this. Yeah, we've got this. We can cruise in the tour. I think if anything, it's probably a negative thing now, if a small thing where they're just sort of even in his team going, oh, maybe we don't have the leader that we thought we had. He's still really good, but suddenly there's this little question, this tiny little question, like, and I don't know the exact thing what happened on the last day. So maybe there was a real reason for it. Maybe he got crook the night before and he miraculously just held it quiet and just got through. I don't know, but, there's just an element of doubt.
He went down in the crash, didn't he? Roglic went down, he hurt his shoulder. I'm not sure if it was the bad shoulder that he hit. Remco Evenepoel also went down. He hurt his shoulder, also had to be checked for concussion. So you can make a case for, Mitch, you know better than any of us, that if you go down and you go down hard, those injuries can take a couple of days to catch up with you, and you don't necessarily feel them the next day or even the day after that. But you know, sort of come 3 days later, then things really start to stiffen up and you really start to suffer all over again. And you can sort of have that delayed onset of the impact.
And I think
I wanted to mention,
just on that, I think let's look at it completely from the other way, from Roglic's side. He's carrying an injury. He's been able to hide that injury from the rest of the peloton and put on this brave face and actually get through and save the Dauphiné from, you know, getting through injured or, you know, not at 100%. So if you look at it from that way, they walk away from the race going, hey, we weren't even functioning at 100% and we still won the hardest race leading into the tour. Imagine when he's not, whatever injury he's carrying from that crash, imagine when he's recovered from that. We're good. So there's now we've just flip-folded and gone back the other way. But it's interesting.
You can be persuaded.
Yeah.
you've got me on one shoulder and Richard on the other. Talk to me, Rich, about, because you made the case of Roglic not being at full strength, but Jorgensen in himself was clearly getting better and better. And you can say that he's really looking like he's on peak form. But as for the rest of his team, he was far from full strength. And I think we've got to double click on the stage 5 crash, which saw, I mean, it just absolutely detonated the race. It saw riders left and right of the road, some of them skidding 300 metres or so. An absolutely horrendous list of casualties. But as far as Visma Lisa bike, almost said Jumbo Visma there, sorry, Visma Lisa bike are concerned, they are now two more riders down, excepting Jonas Vingegaard and Wout van Aert's condition, which we still don't know about. But from the Dauphiné alone, they are down Steven Krauschwig with a hip fracture from that crash and Dylan van Baarle with a right collarbone fracture. And they were both, I think we're all in agreement, they were both pretty much dead certs to go and support their leader at the tour.
Yeah. Yeah, or would have been in the mix, certainly in the long list, right, those two. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of rotten luck, isn't it, for Visma Lisa bike again after the Jonas Vingegaard at the Basque Country, that massive crash in Dwars de Vlaanderen. Jorgensen, touch wood, has skirted around all of that. Another thing worth mentioning as well was Sepp Kuss, who I think people had high hopes of in this race. You know, that sort of final 3 days was perfect for him, really. A lot of climbing, a lot of uphill finishes, And well, he was a, did not start on stage 7 or stage 8, I believe. I think he may well have come down in that crash. It's quite hard to see from, you know, the pictures that we got because of where the crash was. It was, but it, you know, it took out a huge amount of the peloton, didn't it?
He just said he needed the rest, and he didn't have the condition to be where he wanted to be at the business end of the race. So, I mean, they continue to drop like flies. Yeah. It might be Matteo Jorgensen on his own at the tour.
You look at who they've still got, though. They've still got a lot of big name riders who have got the capacity to perform that domestique role pretty well. If they do have a leader, someone like, let's say Jorgensen goes in as a kind of bankable, like, all right, well, we know this guy, he hasn't crashed this year, so we kind of know what we're going to get from him to an extent. You've got guys like Tish Benoot, who actually had a pretty good ride, was going deep into the mountains at the Dauphiné. But guys who can still kind of dictate the racing a little bit, someone like Benoot's got that capacity to kind of not just fetch bottles and support a leader, but actually like play a role in the mountains, I think. And then, well, even Wout van Aert coming back at not 100% fitness still has that capacity to like mix things up and shape the action as well. So, but still, it's a huge question mark, isn't it, over who they're going to send and what form they're going to be in and what they're even going to go for. I mean, it's, you would think they're going to, it'd be almost unimaginable for them to go to the tour and not aim for the GC, but that might actually transpire, that becomes sort of their objectives if they don't have people who are on top form. Jorgensen, I think we know that he's just getting better and better, and I don't think he's found his upper limit, has he? He was second on that Puy de Dôme stage last year, wasn't he? Or he was, you know, the one that Mike Woods won, and really showed that, you know, he can climb with the best of them in a Grand Tour. So I think it wouldn't surprise me if Jorgensen does kind of go there put together a bit of a GC bid, but we don't know that he's a reliable GC contender over 3 weeks at the Tour.
I think there's a couple of things out of that. You know, like, it's been a great opportunity at the moment for Jorgensen to shine, and he's been able to sort of capitalize on this opportunity with these guys being out. And, you know, as you guys know from, you know, different sports, look at cricket, you know, for example, when guys get injured, you only get one chance to shine. And if you don't get that, then they come back from the injury and you never get back in the team. So
let's not talk about cricket, Mitch.
Whatever sport it is, you're trying to break into this one team and you've got this moment. So you've got to seize this opportunity while the others are injured. And he's really been able to do that. I think they'd be really silly not to let him run a GC at the Tour, because regardless of the end result, he needs to see out a whole Grand Tour at that level of pressure to go forward as a rider. And he's ready for it. You know, you don't ride like that at the Dauphiné and not be ready to go the best with the best at the Tour. I'm not going to say he can be on the podium. Can't be on the podium. I actually think he can be on the podium. He just needs to go through those 3 weeks, handle the pressure as being a team leader, go to the Tour with that expectation and see what comes out of it, and he'll grow from that. And who knows, like the way he's riding here, like I really believe that they won't have the same confidence that they will with, obviously, with Vingegaard going there. But, you know, it's a different role, and they will grow so much from doing a whole Grand Tour as a leader.
In a way, the pressure is off Jorgensen too, because there's not necessarily that much expected of him, because he's not tried and tested in that way, in that role, in the 3 week race.
Do you think now, though, coming with this kind of ride at the Dauphiné, it's starting to build up, it's starting to creep in now, you know, these continuously good results without the other riders there, that pressure's surely creeping up. But like you said, no one's expecting him to win.
No one's expecting him to win. So it's a, there's two sides to it again. No one's expecting him to win, but he could, and so that in itself brings a little bit of pressure. I tell you, I almost think are the big winners from the Dauphiné in a strange way. Obviously, they took the final stage with Carlos Rodriguez. Lawrence de Plus looked enormously strong as chief domestique for him, dragging him up seemingly every single climb. My question for you both chaps is, are Ineos the big winners in that they've kind of gone under the radar in terms of expectation at the Dauphiné. They've miraculously avoided the major crashes. It sort of does it suit them better to be where they are now than where they've sort of the expectations have been for them in the past, as in their former guys as Team Sky?
No. I mean Ineos are going to Ineos, aren't they? And they, you know, I think Mitch, you're right in like analysing that last stage. I think they probably did know something that we didn't, but it looked a little bit like Ineos were riding like the old Ineos or the old Team Sky. But what they don't have is a tried and tested leader who can win a Grand Tour. Rodriguez, sure, he was... this is where corrections corner is going to become useful.
You mean at the Dauphiné, or you mean going to the Tour? Because Bernal...
Both. I mean, Bernal, I think,
he's
is still...
he's only won the Tour, I guess.
He's still a question mark. I think there's still a question mark over Bernal. I think, A, whether he's going to go. Yeah, sure, he's won the Tour, but he's suffered two pretty serious injuries after that. And I don't know. I think there's a question mark over whether we will see the Bernal of 2019 this year.
Thomas going there as well?
Is Thomas?
Yeah, but I think after his Giro, he's going there to support. I'm going to preempt your corrections corner. I think Rodriguez finished fifth last year because he finished behind both Yates brothers, didn't he?
I think...
Overall.
I think that we know that Ineos don't have a rider of the caliber of those kind of top four. Remco Evenepoel, Primoz Roglic, and then Pogacar and Vingegaard. I mean, Carlos Rodriguez, he was fourth in the end on the GC at the Dauphiné, a minute down. Laurence Depluis was fifth, who we mentioned already, 2 minutes down. It's better than Remco Evenepoel, seventh, 2:25. So in that sense, yeah, I suppose you can put him up there as a contender, but I'm not sure he's in that same caliber as those front runners. And I think if you're a team like Ineos, they want to win the Tour. Jim Ratcliffe, their owner, is an ambitious man. I mean, there's a lot of news at the moment about what he's doing with Manchester United Football Club here in the UK, where Dave Brailsford is now working, and how he wants to turn that ship around. But he's not going to be content to aim for the podium. They want to win it. But I'm not sure they've got the rider that is going to be able to, you know, the kind of star rider that they can bank on to do that.
One more mention, though. Tom Pidcock. Can he become that style of rider, that sort of rider? He's looking good in Switzerland. He was up there for, I think he finished seventh on yesterday's stage two. And he was quoted as saying this week, I'm going to decide what I want my Tour to be this year. Nobody else. And that's amid rumours of whether there was tension around his role in last year's Tour, tension on the Ineos team bus. So he goes on to say, otherwise, you don't get anything from me. I need to be able to believe in my mission at the Tour. What do you make of this one?
Well, his mission is also Olympic gold, isn't it? The mountain bike.
Yeah, I think, look, I really like where Ineos is at. They've sort of gone away and you've had to rebuild, and they're coming back a little bit off the radar. You know, no one's really expecting heaps from them. You know, I'm not living in the UK, so I don't feel that pressure that they must feel. But, you know, I think it's been a chance for them to rebuild with these younger guys. They're not coming in with that superstar leader and doing their thing. They've recalibrated and they're coming in. You can't underestimate Pidcock. But yeah, look, is he ready to go toe-to-toe with these guys in the three-week race? I haven't seen that yet from him, so it's a big shout. They're very much an opportunist. Opportunist is not the right word. But yes, I don't see them doing the old sort of Ineos boss in the front, you know, doing the big peelers and just sort of having that dominance to ride away.
Okay, gents, we'll leave it there. We will return to a little bit of a Dauphiné roundup and maybe a little bit more on Derek G.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by MAP.
Mitch, business time. Let's talk very briefly about your book, charting, I want to say, 9 grand tours, 22 classics appearances, 4 UCI stage wins, 13 years in the pro ranks. You've got a new book out, Life in the Peloton, available exclusively from our partners, map.cc. Those stats are just a taster. Tell us a little bit. Give us a top line. What can we look forward to with this?
This is your handbook. This is your guide to life in the Peloton. Look, I'm by no means saying this is the Bible and this is how you do it. I'm just saying, look, this is stuff that I've learnt from my time over there. Whether you're someone sitting down watching the Tour de France or whether you're a young pro getting into the Peloton, or actually even if you're just a neo pro or just a young guy over there just going, this book is one of those books where you can just open it up and go, ah, right, that's what's going on now. I don't even know what the hell's going on here. This is your guide to understanding what life is like as a pro. From using stories from my own experience or times when I haven't been there, for instance, how to win Tour of Flanders. I've never won the Tour of Flanders, so I spoke to guys like Alberto Bettiol, or being at the front in a Grand Tour on a mountain. I spoke to Mike Woods, using different examples, learning from my mistakes. But the best part about it is I wrote it with a good mate, Tom Southam, who also wrote the Domestique, Charlie Wigelius' book. He is the director sportif at EF Easy Post. So he's got another little angle as well. We collaborated together and wrote this book together over the last 4 years. It was a lot of fun. And it's out at the perfect time. So everyone getting ready for the tour, this is one of the books you want to have on your coffee table while you're watching the tour, and you can open it up, have a laugh about my antics, but also actually understand a little bit more about the weird, crazy world of pro world tour cycling, because it is a pretty weird sport to try and understand. And after being in there for, like you said, 13 years, it was fun sort of putting it down on paper. Like you said, it is exclusively being sold by Map. So head across to map.cc. You can buy it all around the world. And I'd love to see you guys having a read and having a laugh about it. I can sign one for you. I'll be at the tour.
We'll get that done. I'll be first in the queue. I might recommend it to the people of Kansas as well, so they would understand a little bit more possibly about why you might see two gentlemen in various states of undress in Lycra freshening up before visiting a Mexican restaurant. Anyway, we will leave that bit of business there and double click again on the Dauphiné. And Rich, I want to bring you back in here just because you've got a Tadej Pogacar intelligence brief that you wanted to delve into a little.
I'm gonna disclaimer this and say that I haven't been like loitering around Isola Dormil, which is where Tadej Pogacar now is, along with a lot of riders going up there to Isola.
It's altitude time, though,
isn't it? Station. Altitude time, and it's also Tour Recce time, isn't it? They've swapped the Sierra Nevada for Isola, where I have been there. I drove over. There's a big mountain pass on the other side of it. I want to say the Col de la Lombard. It might not be. It's one of those big ones up there in the Alps, over 2,000 meters, and had to try and find some fresh bread in a out-of-season ski station. And it was like something out of 28 Days Later. Mm-hmm. There was nothing there, nothing going on, nobody. Like, all these big chalets deserted, and then in the middle of it all, a supermarket with like the music playing.
Freaky.
Nobody in the supermarket, but it had everything. It was really bizarre, and like fresh bread. Who knows where they got this warm, fresh bread from at 2,000 meters. You know, you're talking like 20K climb up there from the valley floor, and it's not in the busy part of the Alps either. I just vividly remember that as Isola Dormil. So, yeah. So let's imagine Pogacar. He's sat there in his kind of intelligence briefing room with the UAE boffins and thinking about, well, what are you gonna take away from the Dauphiné? Like, what are the kind of learnings? I mean, Roglic, maybe Bora don't look like the finished article, but I'd see him as a contender. Visma Lisa bike, just a huge massive question mark over that sort of flip chart. You know, imagine the kind of, I think it's probably higher tech, right, than just a massive board with bits of paper and felt tip pens, but
let's stick with the board and pens.
Theatre of the mind. I'm really going to paint a picture of this.
I mean, we're surprised they've got bread up there, so that's, I think, boardroom pens, it's probably the
they've got bread, they've got felt tip pens. I mean, real no expense spared, marginal gains, 2024 going on up there. Ineos, we've covered. Giulio Ciccone up there in the top 10. He finished eighth in the end, but maybe perhaps more of a stage win kind of guy than a GC contender, I think, on that showing. We haven't really talked about Remco Evenepoel, have we? I guess it's a disappointing result for him, seventh overall, 225. But you can't count him out. He won the time trial on stage four. Still, perhaps, I think, coming into this race a little bit undercooked after breaking his shoulder and his collarbone, that crash in the Basque Country. A little bit off his best. Mikel Landa was up there with him. So I think I'd still be worried about Remco. Derek G, we mentioned him at the top of the episode, but what a ride. I mean, Derek G of perennial breakaways in the 23 Giro, but no stage win. He got his first pro win on stage three in the Dauphiné, and then he looked like a Grand Tour contender, didn't he?
And he's got, well, so on that, he went from, you could have got him at 500 to 1 for the overall for the Tour de France at the beginning of the week. And now he's at best 150 to 1. So that in itself shows you. And in fact, Israel Premier Tech, they had people around him too. I know a lot of the time, you know, especially if you're tuning in for the TV coverage late on, then you would have just seen Derek G battling it out with the main GC guys on the final climbs. But Israel Premier Tech had more strength in numbers than you might necessarily have expected them to, particularly when, you know, you consider they had Chris Froome there with them. And as we mentioned last week, Froome's form is not necessarily where it's been in the past. And so wouldn't necessarily be as useful to Derek G if he were to be team leader again when they go to the tour. But Mitch, he backed up sort of the GC ride of his life. Well, the stage ride of his life with another one day after day. It felt like
outside expected that. I think we expected sort of one-offs, but not to go like even just the ride on the final day was so impressive. Just to watch him, I liked watching the battle. I liked watching him just push himself. You don't get to see that too often. That full exposure of, you know, that rawness. I'm actually on my limit completely, and I'm going to just keep going deeper. I love seeing it. You could just tell how much he was trying, you know, for lack of a better word there. It was really cool. I liked also, sorry, just a slight change to go back to Ciccone. I liked the way that Trek were riding. They seem like a unit there in the Dauphiné. So I think, you know, without Tao, unfortunately, sort of having to stop after that crash, I think they're a team that's been riding well all year, you know, in support of, yeah, through the classics we saw, they rode really well at the Giro. It's just looking like a really strong unit. I liked what, you know, Carlos Verona moving across there. So, yeah, that was my other takeaway, aside from Derek G, not to leave him now, but I just wanted to quickly slip that in there as well before I forgot about it.
Just a quick word on Tao as well. So Tao Geoghegan-Hart, he reckons he hit a telegraph pole in that crash so he came off his bike, slid along the road at about 45 kilometers an hour and then hit a telegraph pole. So he was okay to start stage six, and he made it with the main bunch to that final climb at the end of the stage. But then he almost came to an absolute standstill and finished 23 minutes down. So he was saying he was just finding it was too difficult to breathe because his ribs had taken such an impact. So we wish Tao well and hope he recovers, because the tour is on his program, isn't it? He should be at the Tour de France.
On that, I mean, let's not dwell on this too much, but I mean, I'm sure like the rest of the world, I found myself doing physics equations on stage six, watching Primoz Roglic.
I'm sure we all did, Mitch, didn't we?
Right away. Yeah. No, what I was curious about was, you know, how the sort of zeitgeist or the rhetoric at the moment around pro cycling is that speeds are getting faster and faster. And I was kind of curious because there was a discussion around, you know, it's another big crash, all these riders taken out, Visma Lisa bike really affected by it. Richard Pluger, their team boss, went on Twitter and basically kind of stirred it up a little bit by saying, like, would this happen in Formula One? Would the safety organization take measures up front? I mean, we don't need to dive into that whole polemic because I think it's a very complex issue. But I was just curious about, like, if you're going a little bit faster, as we kind of think the riders are, like, how much more serious are crashes? And just as a little takeaway, if you're rolling along at 25k an hour, which I might be on like a winter bike out here on these grippy roads in the UK, you're carrying about a third of the energy and there's like the force on you that you would compared to just an increase of 5k an hour between 70k an hour and 65k an hour. This sounds really complicated, but basically the faster you go, the increases in like the force and the extremity of a crash get higher and higher and higher. It's like a kind of exponential scale. So we know that all these riders are getting faster from aerodynamics. They're going faster for longer thanks to all the changes in nutrition. And so I think, I don't know, it feels a little bit like that's what we're seeing is when you have riders taken out by these crashes, it's not so much perhaps that crashes are becoming more frequent, but the increases in the speed are making them a lot worse. There's a lot more energy in there, a lot more. That's like a kind of, I'm sure we'll get complaints now from people who are much more qualified in physics and maths than I am to kind of talk about that. But it just got me thinking, because I think it's an issue that is not going to go away. Like what we do about crashes, or what the sport does about crashes, if anything at all, whether it's sort of an onus on the race organizers or whether it's something that the team should look into. I mean, it, you know, Mitch, I'm sure this is something you've talked about as well, and you know, the way that the peloton as well has gone from being kind of you know, you could go to races, perhaps not the Dauphiné, but you could go to races slightly undercooked or out of shape, and now we're seeing riders who are in general a lot leaner, a lot fitter, and they have to be on that kind of peak form. And perhaps, I don't know, maybe playing devil's advocate here, a little bit more vulnerable if they were to crash.
I don't know if I'd go that far in saying that, you know, they're more fragile. Is that what you're suggesting? But I think I agree with you, the peloton, in a way, whether it's the speed or, you know, the frequency of crashes, I take a different sort of angle on that, and I'm always banging on about it that, you know, the skill level isn't the same in the peloton. But that may be down to, you know, I've always said that it's down to riders getting opportunities before they're ready for it, in terms of physically they're ready, but, you know, skill-wise, bunch, you know, skill and, you know, racing sort of skill, I'm trying to think of another word, sorry, I can't, racing skill, you know, this is the understanding of how to move around the peloton as a young guy. You learn that through, you know, track racing or even just a lot of road racing or whatever that is, and then eventually when you get your chance at pro, it's just sort of the natural step up. But we're seeing a lot of guys sort of cherry picked out of sort of young juniors when they haven't done much racing because they've got the engine, and all of a sudden they're learning those kind of skills when they're at the top level. And you put a few too many of them together with that increased speed that you're talking about, and in my opinion, the lack of respect in the bunch, which we've seen sort of thrown out the window now, where, you know, back in the day, back in the old times, there was a bit of like, you know, earn your stripes on your jersey. You're not going to go and push someone off a wheel if you were just a young Neo Pro. You earned your position in the bunch. And I came into the peloton around sort of that period, and it changed over my time, and it's kept changing again. And that's, I think all those things rolled up together, and, you know, that's me sitting on the fence again. It's very difficult to say it's one thing. But I think I agree that the increased speed of the peloton, the bunch not having the skill to move with the speed of the bunch, the peloton, to move with that increased speed. But then also this lack of respect, people, and that's the push from the directors, the push from, we need to just race all the time. Don't worry about those guys. Don't worry about having a piss-o. Just attack. Just get up there. Push in on that guy's wheel. Like this kind of stress we're getting in the radio, that creates another element of unsafety in the peloton.
Mitch, have you been in the pack in those sort of situations? So the crash happened on an arrow straight road. it was obviously freshly tarmacked, and you could see, you know, in the rain, you could see the surface sort of glistening through the cameras. Have you been in any sort of situation like that where you kind of get a feeling that, you know, you can presumably feel your bike start to slip and slide beneath you, right? And you're not the only one. All the other guys are going to be having exactly the same sensation. At what point do you vocalise that? At what point do the bunch start to vocalise that and say, well, hold on a sec here, lads, like, if we don't start to take this seriously, then we're gonna come a cropper pretty quickly? Because that doesn't seem to have happened. Was that just because they didn't have time to do it, because they were going at such a pace?
Very difficult to understand that exact scenario. But in general, those types of scenarios, you know, there would just be a general consensus that over the majority would be like, this is dangerous and I'm not going to keep pushing. So there wasn't necessarily a general consensus where everyone went, hey, guys, everyone, let's slow down, you know, all this sort of thing. Just more than the majority sort of felt, hey, I'm not going to push it now. So you just generally had this feeling in the bunch, we're going to just ease or take a bit of a notch off on this corner. But what sort of progressively happened is the majority's tipped the other way where, and I noticed it all the time, I'd be sitting in the bunch and there'd be guys pushing in my wheel on certain corners, and you'd notice that, hang on, I'm getting pushed back three or four wheels because I'm leaving a gap on this descent, one bike length gap, so I've got a chance to brake for the corners, and someone would come and take that bike length gap. You're like, okay, I'll leave another gap because I want to sort of leave a bit more buffer for myself, and someone would take that. You're like, what's going on here? Guys are like, screw it. I'm just going to keep taking risks. That means I can just move up one more position. So I think what's sort of general to answer your question is, a lot more guys are like, well, the consensus is I can keep moving forward and just keep pushing forward and worry about that later on. What watching from the race, I could see in that was, it was exactly what you said. It was super slippery. Someone braked and guys at the back were just crashing because they weren't feathering the brakes, or, you know, they weren't ready for something like that. Whether that was the urge to keep moving forward, or whether the road was just ridiculously slippery, I can't tell exactly from that situation. But in general, you know, I'm going on a big long-winded answer here. In general, I believe the stress of guys trying to be in position, the stress to be in the race, and we've talked about this in many facets of where races is going, the condition of riders, blah, 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 the bikes. Just in general, everyone's pushing harder.
Yeah, and I should say as well, because it wasn't, we're talking about it like it was one crash, but it wasn't. It was lots of little crashes, and it was one group of riders, but another, you know, in twos, threes, fours, just going down all over the place. And Mitch, I think that sort of speaks to what you said, was which was, you touch the brakes, you know, you don't feather the brakes, or you touch the brakes, and all of a sudden you just wash out. And that happened. That seemed to happen here, there, and everywhere.
I think I couldn't remember if this had happened ever before. I was actually speaking to Simon Gerrans earlier today, and he said, you can't forget the Tour de France a few years ago when it finished up the Meurthe-Mohoric, and the race was neutralized also because they ran out of ambulances. I completely forgot about that. You know, it's not like it's never happened before. So maybe we're just looking at it in different eyes. It's easy just to continually go, oh, the bunch is changing so much, it's so dangerous. But has this stuff happened before? You know, are we just focusing on it too much?
They neutralized that stage, of course. One young man who finished that stage, but that then had to withdraw from the race the following day, not because he was injured from a crash, but because he tested positive for COVID. Lucas Nuruka, son of Richard Nuruka, who raced the 1996 Atlanta Olympics for Team GB, marathon runner, finished fifth. And still holds, I think I'm right in saying, he still holds the sixth fastest time in UK history, running 2 hours, 8 minutes, 36 seconds at the London Marathon. He was very impressive, Rich, to bring that very long, it's a long-winded day all of a sudden, to bring that back round. EF Education, Easy Posts, sort of a breakout rider from this race.
Yeah, I mean, I like that about EF. They kind of always come out with, you don't quite know who it's going to be in the next race. There's going to be somebody who maybe you haven't heard a huge amount of before. Georg Steinhauser obviously was the breakout rider in the Giro, wasn't he? And like interesting backstory, interesting character. In both cases, I think for Georg and for Lucas. Yeah, is he going to go to the Tour, do we think?
Steinhauser is not sure on the list. I don't know about Lucas either.
Still a little early for kind of final decisions, isn't it, for Tour teams and so on. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe we'll, after 3 weeks of running club on the Tour de France, will we have a stab at the, you and I, Graham, will have a go at the British record? Yeah,
can you imagine? Mitch is going to need more of these Bromptons to drag us back to whichever apartment we're staying in.
Yeah, if Mitch's Brompton materialises, then maybe we can have a. We might be able to break 2 hours for the 26 miles on the Brompton.
Dave Miller, he's bringing that Brompton over. Thanks, Dave. Just confirming that you.
Yeah. No pressure, Dave. Mitch is relying on you. He's worried.
Very, very quickly, gents. Let's give us a runway to the end of this episode. Anything we've missed? I should just say, actually, Naroko finished third. Was his best professional finish yet. Finished third on stage three, just 3 seconds behind stage winner Derek G. And Romain Grégoire, FDJ's Romain Grégoire in second. Anything else apart from that we might have missed, Richard?
Well, a couple of riders I want to point to who had, you know, pretty good rides, and I think we're going to see good things of them at the Tour. Josh Tarling, second in the TT, going deep in the mountains. That was a big ride from him. So I'm intrigued to see what Josh Tarling can do in the Tour. Mads Pedersen looks insanely strong again. Just a kind of big wrecking ball of a rider. And Oya Lazcano, you spot that, ninth on GC from a big classics rider. I don't know what kind of numbers you need to be doing as a classics rider, Mitch, to be getting up like in the front group in a mountain stage race. But
I had to double take when I saw him up there. I was like, is it him? Is it the same guy that I remember? I want to have a quick shout out to Callum Scotson, who really surprised me as well. He finished 13th on general classification. He was riding in with Remco Evenepoel most of the climbs, and he's just taken a massive leap forward. You know, he's not sort of new. He's been riding on Mitchelton since I think 2018, so he's been around, or 2019, been around. But just for the Aussies out there listening, it's good to see, you know, another sort of young guy who's been plugging away over there come forward in such a tough race.
All right, gents, I think with that little bit of pressure on Dave Miller, we'll leave it there for the time being. But our cycling podcast Tour de France team, A team, will be back next week when there will only be, I think I'm right in saying, 11 days to go before it all begins. So we better head off and go and binge watch Netflix's Tour de France Unchained in the meantime. And we'll see you next week. Mitch, good to be with you all the way from down under.
I'll go binge read Life in the Peloton book.
Oh, very nice. Richard, try and say goodbye without plugging anything.
Mitch, can you bring a copy for the car, please, for the Tour?
You're doing live read in the car.
live audiobook from Mitch while he's driving.
Good, something to look forward to, something else to look forward to. From me, until next week, gents, it's goodbye for now.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.